Well, since we just started with BPF, the next BPF-related topic, I didn't remember I put it back to back, but I remember that I put the one of this one after the previous one, of course. But yeah, so maybe as a quick poll, who has used BPF trace before in this room? Okay, yeah, some, okay. Yeah, so once again, I'm not an expert really. This is all very introductory for this kind of tool. Just wanted to share a bit of my experience, which sadly already is mostly at least 1 year ago. I think I didn't use it much during the last year or so, so it might be rusty at times, my memory. Yeah, if you've used it already, this is unlikely very interesting to you. But yeah, let's see. So what is BPF trace? It's a high-level tracing language and a runtime. So we have two parts, the runtime actually and the language itself. It's based on eBPF, hence the name BPF trace, as we just Niels has just reminded us about. So it does static and dynamic tracing, and you can trace stuff both in kernel and user space. It's extremely powerful to do all kinds of things. I probably have not scratched more than 1% of it so far. So just to make sure what we are talking about here, what is tracing in this context is basically, I would define it, this is not a formal definition, but based on my understanding in this context, basically you could say it's the ability to interrupt the flow of a running program at configurable locations in the code. There's several different mechanisms how you basically sort of define the location where you actually want to do something, like at which point in time, at which part of the code. Then you execute some code, you trace code to obtain some data. So for example, how large are the writes that I'm writing or something, or what was the time at this event or something like this. The code that you execute once you've reached that point where you want to do something, that again is using eBPF, since we already have eBPF in the kernel, we can attach BPF programs to all those locations, to those trace points. And the point of all of this is to increase the visibility of what's happening and when, and to aggregate some data before we pass it to user space. Because of course, if we insert some additional code to generate some traces, that of course will affect the performance of our system. So we have a sort of Heisenberg situation. The closer we look at something, the more tracing we do, the more we affect the timing of the system, and the less realistic it is what we're looking at. And so we want to sort of keep the fast path or the hot path very small and extract only the relevant information, so that copying and passing all that information to user space doesn't impose even more of a burden on the interface. So spontaneous opinion would be sort of the opposite of perf, right? With perf, you sample all the data you can get, and you sample it, and you sample it, and then you have this massive amount of data, and you sort of process it. And here, it's really at the time when something happens, you already extract whatever is relevant to you at that point, and then you pass it on further. So it's a bit different. I mean, I'm not saying it's better, it's just a different approach for different problems. So what is static tracing? Static tracing means in the code you already have hard-coded instrumentation points which were explicitly created by the author of the trace software. We already have some, very few of those in LibOSMO Core. I will show you. I introduced them years ago when debugging some problem. You could say those are part of, let's say, the stable API, and you can document them and so on. And anyone who wants to analyze something can then use them. And you can, of course, define what kind of data is available at this trace point and so on. And that can be done relatively efficient. I'm not sure how it's implemented in detail. I know some other mechanisms like this, maybe not necessarily this one. They work by having like knobs in the object code, and then you insert an instruction. When you activate the trace point, you replace the knobs with a jump to some code. When you remove the trace point, you put the knobs in again in the executable code, so you you basically don't lose anything other than a couple of bytes of executable file size. So the overhead of introducing this in the code is low, And therefore, it's you can do that. So dynamic tracing is different. Basically, you do this at unforeseen points. So the software developer of the program didn't put some explicit hook in somewhere for tracing, but you do it more like, think of it like you put a watch point or a breakpoint or something somewhere, and then you do something somewhere in a program, like you could do with GGB. That's more a dynamic tracing approach. And that obviously needs a symbol table, whereas the previous one doesn't, because that trace point itself is explicitly defined by the author in static tracing, but dynamic tracing you just do somewhere. So we have something called probe providers in BPF trace. And then each probe provider provides probe points. And then at the probe point, you can execute some code. And there's some probe providers which are sort of really, they're not really, they just put it in there, but it's not really what you would expect. So begin and end, so basically you can write some code that gets executed when you start the BPF trace program and when you terminate it. So like initialize some data structures or compute some aggregate values at axis, something like this. They're just implemented the same way. So basically when you write a BPF program, it's like not like writing a C program with a single main function, but you sort of write a program that has many different entry points, and one of them is the begin, which would be like your main in C, and the end is sort of, well, something else that you call it the end, and then you have all kinds of other potential functions that you can register or hook into, which are provided by different probe providers. So we have hardware probe provider. These are processor level events. There is interval, which is code that gets periodically called. So if you want to do some statistics over time, then you can say, well, at an interval of I don't know how many milliseconds, something should happen, for example. Then we have kprobe and kretprobe. That's a generic mechanism in the kernel for tracing kernel function entry and exit, so red probe return probing and k probe at the beginning of the function. Profiling is, well, yeah, well, what you know, I guess I don't need to go into that. Then we have software events, trace points, and so on. And there's also the equivalent of k probe is u probe and u red probe for user level function trace points. So each of those generate a lot, provide a lot of different trace points. If you want to look at the available probes, you can do BPF trace minus L, and I'm just doing a line count, and it's 153,000 different probe points that my laptop here has. And that, of course, excludes any additional probe points that the library or program that I actually may want to trace in user space might in addition provide to that. So that's just what I have out of the box from the kernel, basically. And I can attach stuff to that. So yeah, as I said, we define small functions and we define when they get executed. So this has larger font size, yeah. So I changed this. I didn't regenerate the slides, the other one. So this is the most basic example, one of the most basic examples you can do, right? We basically say we want to register to something the trace point probe provider provides, and to a syscall, and specifically to sysenter openAT. So this is a trace point provided in the kernel whenever the openAT system call is entered. And then we print a format string where we print the com and the args.filename. So to know that in context, you need to know that in modern systems, all open functions that you make use the openAT system call. So anytime you open a file, it goes through that call. And com now is a variable that in BPF trace programs is a built-in variable that has the current process name. So basically the first argument of a printf will be the program name, and the second argument is the file name of what you're opening. And this args is another built-in, you could say, variable of BPF trace. It is a structure that contains all the arguments of the trace point. And if you want to look at what kind of structures are available at a given trace point, you can use this command, minus VL, for a given trace point. And if you do that, then it will tell you sort of what, we can do that later. look at what kind of, like here, for example, the file name member of the structure, it will tell you that this exists. And the str function is another built-in function to convert that into a string, because from that structure it might not be clear that it's a string type. So it looks almost like C, you know, if you look this printf and format string and so on. So the language that you write in BPS phrase is close to C, but only superficially. Yeah, so how do we execute a program? Well, we can just call it BPF tries minus E and then put in quotes the entire program. I mean, this scrolls way beyond the slide because it's I don't want to scroll now. But it's basically the entire example here put in one line and passing that to the trace point, to the BPF trace program as an argument. So let me actually try to do that. No. Let's do it like this. So we copy and paste this entire thing. I'm not sure if it copies everything. We'll see. Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course, I need to do sudo. Yeah, and you can see that any program that opens any file, after you start the program, you get these lines printed. So the UPowerD was doing some whatever ACPI device. And here we have the ThinkFan daemon that opens the hardware monitor temperature input to regulate the fans on the system. So this becomes immediately active on a system level. So any open by any process gets executed, the code that you specify gets executed. That may not always be what you want. So there's a capability to filter, but let's just do this example here as well, this VL, so we get this description of the structure. Yeah, again. So we see that the enter open AT trace point has an integer system call number, then the DFD, probably file descriptor, I'm not sure, then we have the file name, flags, and the mode. So basically whatever kind of metadata is available at the time you open a file, that gets passed in this struct, and this is the args that you get and that you can use in the program there. Now, the other option is you put your program in a text file for more complex program. That's of course the normal part. You just put in a text file and you execute BPF trace, giving that as an argument the file. You can also do shebang kind of script execution style, like a bash script, so you can put the first line BPF trace and then execute that script this way. So another nice feature is the built-in histograms. So this is a BPF trace example where we say basically, well, we want to trace the system call sysexit, we read. So when we leave the read call, when the read call completes, and then we have this new part that we didn't see in the previous example. This is between the slashes is a filter expression. So we don't get this for every read on a system, but only for reads of this specific process ID. So PID, again, is a built-in variable. You could also do it with com, the program name. So I have some other examples where I put osmo slash as a prefix match, so only all the osmocom programs that are running, all processes that have osmo dash in the beginning are the ones that I want to look at. And what I'm doing then here is this at bytes is basically I'm defining a new dict here, and it's a histogram type of the return value of the arguments part of the read exit. So what I'm getting then, and attach the probe, and when it doesn't do anything, I don't see any output because there's no print statement in there. But when I terminate the program with Control C, I will get the ASCII histogram representation, and this basically tells me, well, between the time of attaching the probe and pressing Control C, I'm getting there were reads of 0 or 1, there were 12 reads of 0 or 1 bytes, and there were 19 reads between 64 and 128 bytes. So that's what I'm getting there. And that's rather nice to analyze well, stuff with system calls, with this syscall entry, syscall exit. You can look at what's happening and what sizes and so on. And this very powerful, this built-in histogram. So this is another example from an example from a BPF example. Yeah, unfortunately, the line wrapping somehow didn't work when I changed the font size of the slide thingy. But yeah, it's timing the read. So here we actually build another dict or map or whatever you want to call it, indexed by the TID. That's probably the thread ID in this context. And we at the end at the read enters the VFS read execution, we put the nsex is the number of nanoseconds. It's an automatic built-in timer variable of BPF trace. So we put in this map indexed by the thread ID, we put the nanoseconds, and then we have a kret probe with VFS read where we then subtract. I can show you the example, but basically the point is we want to compute the time that a read is taking. And this is now the amount of nanoseconds that were spent for a read call. And we again get the histogram of something like this. So we can basically see how long did a certain function call or a certain system call or something like this take. Now, some OsmoCom examples. This was for counting polls. So I say, well, the sysenter poll trace point, and if, well, actually I'm doing this here, yeah, because prefix match is not available as a filter expression, so I have to do it in explicit code. Well, if the beginning of my program name is Osmo, then I have the polls total dict for the given process, for com, for, let's say, the Osmo BTS, Osmo BSC, something like that. I increment that. And if the timeout is zero, then I have a second one to increment that. So basically the point of this is to get an idea of how many poll calls have a zero timeout for each of the programs that I'm executing. And I get separate counts on, this is an interval here, so every 100 millisecond, it will print those four, print those two and clear them again. So every 100 milliseconds, I'm getting an output that tells me how many poll calls of my OsmoCom programs had a zero timeout and how many poll calls were there in total. At that time, we were trying to find out why on earth a poll was called with a zero timeout, because sort of if you know that, why are you calling poll if you're immediately returning? There was a second example, but it's copy and paste. I didn't reload maybe here in the browser. Yeah, okay, it was just the browser reload that was missing. So the second slide, again, where we only want to look at Osmo BSC, the number of polls total, number zero, and we print this way. So this was just for Osmo BSC. You can use that filter expression. But if you want all the OsmoCom, like prefix matching or something, I don't think you can put it in the filter expression. It's not that meaningful, so you need to do like an explicit string number compare at the beginning to do that. We had this, we still have actually, the Osmo MSC SQLite issue that I gave up on or didn't find time anymore to complete 2 years ago. This issue has a lot of examples where BPF trace was used, and this is one that I like particularly. Is sort of we do a U probe in the libdbi for the query f functions, and then we create a map or dict or whatever you want to call it with the query string, and we count the number of executions. So you actually get output like this, where you say, well, this query, the count of the number of this query was 7. So you see which SQL statements are executed how often while you were tracing. So you get an idea like which of the SQL statements are executed more frequently than others, things like that. So in terms of the static, oh, I forgot the F11 after the shell, sorry. The st- static user space trace points in LibOSMO Core. This was what I introduced when we were looking at logging performance, and we figured out that in the end, by this kind of help and many other bits, that our standard output standard error was still blocking at that time. So logging to a file or logging to a syslog or anything like this was fine, but as soon as you still had some log output to standard error output, this would actually be blocking writes, which could delay the process. And so in order to debug this, I introduced the log start and log done probe points in LibOSMO Core. There's a file called probes.d where you define the probes that you have. And this file, there's some autoconf voodoo that generates a header file from this. And the code that was manually added in the logging.c file is basically just a couple of trace defines where we, if system tap is enabled, that's basically this USDT stuff, then we include the probes.h file and those trace macros do something, and if not, they don't. And in order to enable this, you have to use the dash dash, did I have it here? I don't have it here. So you need to configure with dash dash enable dash system tap or something, and then those become defined. So in the end, in the code, we put, this is the normal log P2 function of LibOSMO Core, and this line trace LibOSMO Core log start and trace LibOSMO Core log done was the two lines that I had to add to the code. And as I said, those should be fairly low overhead if the trace points are not used. As far as I understand, I didn't investigate this at a low level detail. And now we can have a LibOSMO Core program like this, or sorry, a BPF program for LibOSMO Core like this. We say, well, this beginning is just a hello, what it does. And then we have the USDT for the shared object file of LibOSMO Core with the log start and the log done. And the log start for a given thread ID, basically PID, but in multi-threaded, it's a per thread ID. We take the nanoseconds at start, and then when the logging is done, we subtract the then nanoseconds from the starting nanoseconds, we divide it by 1,000, so we get microseconds, and we take a histogram of that, and we delete the temporary start timestamp that we created here. And in the end, we just clear everything and we print it. And from that, we get, I don't have the output here, but we get a histogram of how long the various log start, log end calls took, and we see sort of if there are any log statements that take too long. Just a second, I think, yeah, we're already at further reading, so then we can take questions. Please wait for the microphone.
Just get something to drink. So when I used BPF trace, I thought, okay, what do I have to do? How do I have to change my program? And then it turns out I don't even have to restart it or anything. I can just run BPF trace and get hooks into a specific function in my code that I didn't touch in any way. So I'm wondering, how does it do it? How is it possible and still, you know, efficient? I mean, how is it done?
I can't tell you in detail. I didn't implement it. I didn't look at how it's implemented. For the completely dynamic tracing. It's just that the dynamic tracing uses it's efficient, but if many people say it's not efficient, so that's why the static tracing exists. That's why for the logging I introduced the static hooks. So I guess I cannot comment on what the overhead is, but for sure any kind of dynamic tracing always has quite a bit of overhead introduced.
Yeah, I could say something. So I looked into ftrace, which was before BPF came in, and ftrace just added some hooks for every function enter and exit with a knob. And if you activate ftrace, and I think BPF can hook also on all traces, they replace the knob in the kernel space and replace the knob with the jump and jump then back. So if you use tracing, there is an overhead. Otherwise, like you also said, there's a knob.
Yeah, but that can work if you have such a generic framework in the kernel. But for a user space program, your compiler doesn't insert those knobs. So I'm not sure how a dynamic user space tracing, like how it's... It does? Yeah? So. Okay. So yeah, maybe you can answer that, yeah.
The Linux kernel has to know about the local machine code and will then just edit the machine code in RAM while it's executed, for example, replace a jump to a function call with an interrupt, and then, yeah.
Okay, but it's an interrupt or something then, and yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, okay, as I said, I didn't look at the details of the implementation. Yeah, Paul?
I could say I didn't look into it, but I guess it just like replaces some instruction with a jump somewhere else, and I just like it's a trampoline, and then just goes back and continues the execution. So probably it's not efficient because then basically you are jumping to some other memory region. So basically the code cache is just, and on the static one probably just put in place. So yeah, you don't have this problem.
I mean, one of the other advantages of having the static trace points is also that you sort of give the potential user some guideline what would be nice, what would be a good location to trace, right? So the log start, log end, that's very clear, but in like log P2, or they have so many different logging related functions, you have to read all the code to figure out where you do I need to dynamically insert the trace point, and if some is predefined, then it's very clear what is a good point to trace this subsystem. Yeah.
Yeah, so that SQLite thing that we were looking at appeared on some hardware and not on others. So, I mean, in the end, we decided to do something else, but we still didn't. So it's still there. So if one did want to look at that, can you also trace maybe like a hard disk hardware controller driver or something? Or how, like all of those 150,000 trace options, is that like a sort of core kernel syscalls, or can you like would a network controller driver also have possibilities to do something when packet is received at that level, or how far down can you go?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why is it? Oh, it just takes so long to. I mean, you can see really it goes. It always depends on the subsystem. So this is AES crypto code in the kernel and so on. You said something about a block device. Let's look for block. I'm not quite sure. Well, you can actually. Yeah, I wouldn't know, like I would have to check what the specific subsystem, what it has. But the problem, of course, yeah, here is the block requests and dirty buffers, block IO start and so on. So you clearly have in a generic block and in file system specific code, butterfs and so on. So there are all kinds of places that you can trace and so on, but you would really have to understand a specific subsystem. And of course, once you leave something that is executed on behalf of a process, it will be difficult to impossible to attribute it to a given process, right? So in the kernel, if you trace it, if you want to trace something that happens in the user space program, sort of at a system call, you still know which program triggered the write. But by the time it has gone through the file system and you end up in the block device layer, you have no clue which program made that write anymore, because it's like seven layers of abstraction across. So yes, you can trace whatever how long probably is how long an IO request took, but yeah, which of those requests it was. Okay, one more.
Yeah, I guess there's also some functionality to print stack traces.
Yes, there is. You can also do backtraces and histograms of backtraces. I did that once. It was sort of not ideal, but I could get some value on it. So basically, you can say, well, take the backtrace of, I don't know, I think with a certain depth, and then you can use that as a key into a histogram. So you can basically say, oh, my function was most often like 300 whatever 7 times was called through this path, but then sometimes it was called through another call path. So you can do things like this. Yeah, that's true. Okay, good. Then thanks for your attention.